Sometimes I think I have, sometimes I think I haven't, especially when I think of my mother. That means, I suppose, that I haven't really forgiven him. Lana leaned forward then, resting her hand on my knee. Perhaps forgiveness is overrated, she said. Her face was closer to me than ever before, and all I needed to do was lean forward. It was then I committed the most perverse act of my life. I declined, or rather, I reclined, putting distance between me and that beautiful face, the tempting crevice of those slightly parted lips. I should go, I said. You should go. From the expression on her face, it was clear she had never heard those words before from a man. She would not have looked so astonished if I had asked her to commit the most heinous acts of Sodom. I stood up before I changed my mind, handing her the guitar. There's something I must do, before I can do what needs to be done here. It was her turn to recline, amused, and strum a dramatic chord. Sounds serious, she said. But you know what? I like serious men. If only she knew how serious I could be. I drove the hour between her apartment and Sonny's with my hands at 10 and 2 o'clock, breathing deeply and methodically to quell my regret at leaving Lana and my nervousness at meeting him. Breathing mindfully was a lesson Claude had taught me, learned from the practices of our Buddhist monks. Everything came down to focusing on the breath, slowly exhaling and inhaling. One cleared away life's white noise, leaving one's mind free and peaceful to be one with the object of its contemplation. When subject and object are the same, Claude said, you don't shake when you squeeze the trigger. By the time I parked my car around the corner from Sonny's apartment, my mind was a gull gliding over a beach, carried not by its own will or movement, but by the breeze. I took off my blue polo shirt and slipped on a white T-shirt. I kicked off my brown loafers and removed my khakis, then pulled on a pair of blue jeans and beige canvas shoes. Last to go on was a reversible windbreaker, the plaid side exposed, and a fedora. Leaving the car, I carried with me a free tote bag I had received for subscribing to Time magazine, inside of which was a small backpack, the clothes I had just shed, a baseball cap, a blonde wig, a pair of tinted glasses, and a black Walther P-22 with a silencer. The general had given Bond an envelope of cash, and with it, Bond had bought the pistol and silencer from the same Chinese gang that had supplied him with the .38. Then he had made me rehearse the plan with him until I memorized it. The sidewalk was barren from car to apartment. Walking the streets was not an American custom, as I had confirmed after observing the neighborhood several times. It was a little past 9 o'clock when I checked my watch at the entrance to his apartment building, a gray, two-story factory for manufacturing hundreds of tired replicas of the American dream. All the inmates imagined their dreams to be unique, but they were merely tin reproductions of a lost original. I rang the intercom. "Hello?" he said. When I announced my presence, there was a slight pause before he said, "I'll buzz you in." I took the stairs instead of the elevator to avoid meeting anyone. On the second floor, I peeked into the hallway to make sure no one was there. He opened the door a second after I knocked. The apartment smelled like home, the scent of fried fish, steamed white rice, and cigarette smoke. "I know why you're here," he said as I sat down on his couch. I clutched the tote bag. "Why am I here?" I said. "Sophia," he said, as serious as I was, even though his feet were in fuzzy pink slippers. He wore sweatpants and a gray cardigan. On the dining table behind him hunkered a typewriter with a lip of paper dangling from its roller, the machine abutted by haphazard mounds of documents. Under the dining table's chandelier, above an ashtray, floated a slowly dissipating cloud of smoke, the exhaust from Sonny's active brain. And on the wall above the table, through that scrim, hung the same clock as in the General and Madame's restaurant, also set to Saigon time. "We never did have the talk we should have had about her," he said. "Our last conversation was uncomfortable. I apologize for that. If we had been decent about it, we would have written you a letter in the Philippines." His unexpected and seemingly genuine concern for my welfare caught me off guard. "It was my fault," I said. "I never wrote her in the first place myself." We both looked at each other for a moment, and then he smiled and said, I'm being a bad host. I haven't even offered you a drink. How about it? Despite my protestations, he leapt up and went to the kitchen, exactly as Bond predicted. I put my hand on the Walther P-22 in the tote bag, but I could not find the will to stand up, follow him into the kitchen, and quickly put a bullet behind his ear, as Bond had advised. "It's a merciful thing to do," he said. Yes, it was, but the lump of starch in my stomach glued me to the couch, upholstered in a scratchy, stain-resistant fabric designed for motel room trysts. Stacks of books on the industrial carpet sandbagged the walls, and on top of the antique television, a silver stereo muttered. Above the armchair, a blotchy, amateurish painting in the style of a demented Monet illustrated an interesting principle, that beauty is not needed to make a milieu more attractive. A very ugly object can also make an ugly room less ugly by comparison. Another affordable way to add a drop of loveliness to the world was not to change it, but to change how one saw it. This was one of the purposes for the bottle of bourbon that Sonny returned with, a third full. "You hear that?" he said, nodding at the stereo. The two of us cuddled the glasses of bourbon in our laps. After all the Cambodian attacks on our border towns, we just raided Cambodia. You'd think we'd had enough of war that we wouldn't want another one. I thought about how the border clash with the Khmer Rouge was an incredible stroke of good luck for the general, a distraction to keep everyone looking elsewhere than our Laotian border. "The problem with winning," I said, "is that everyone's so riled up they're ready to fight again." He nodded and sipped his bourbon. "The good thing about losing is it keeps you from fighting another war, at least for a while, although that's not true for your general." I was about to protest when he raised his hand and said, "Forgive me, I'm talking politics again." "I swear not to talk about politics tonight, my brother. You know how hard that is for someone who believes everything is political." "Even bourbon," I said. He grinned. "All right. So perhaps bourbon is not political. I don't know what to talk about besides politics. It's a weakness. Most people can't tolerate it. But Sophia can. I talk to her like no one else. That's love. So you're in love with her. You weren't in love with her, were you? She said you weren't." "If she said so, then I guess I wasn't." "I understand. Losing her hurts even if you didn't love her. That's human nature. You want her back. You don't want to lose her to someone like me. But please, see it from my point of view. We didn't plan anything. It's just that when we started talking at the wedding, we couldn't stop. Love is being able to talk to someone else without effort, without hiding, and at the same time to feel absolutely comfortable not saying a word. At least that's one way I figured out how to describe love. I've never been in love before. It leaves me with this strange need to find the right metaphor to describe being in love, like I am a windmill and she is the wind. Stupid, yes?" "No, not at all," I mumbled, realizing we had broached a topic more problematic than politics. I looked down at the nearly empty glass cupped in my hand, and through the skim of bourbon at the bottom of the glass I saw the red scar. "It's not her fault," he said. "I gave her my number at the wedding and asked for hers because I said, wouldn't it be great if I could write an article about how a Japanese sees us Vietnamese?" "Japanese-American," she corrected me, "not Japanese. And Vietnamese-American, not Vietnamese. You must claim America," she said. "America will not give itself to you. If you do not claim America, if America is not in your heart, America will throw you into a concentration camp or a reservation or a plantation. And then, if you have not claimed America, where will you go?" "We can go anywhere," I said. "You think that way because you weren't born here," she said. "I was, and I have nowhere else to go. If I have children, they too would have nowhere else. They will be citizens. This is their country." At that moment, with those words of hers, a desire I had never experienced came over me. I wanted to have a child with her. Me, who had never wanted marriage, who could never imagine being a father. "Can I have another drink?" "Of course," he refilled my glass. "You stupid bastard," Bond's voice in my head said. "You're making this worse. Get it over with." "Now," Sonny continued, "I realize that so far as children and fatherhood goes, it's more dream than possibility. Sophia is past her childbirthing years, but there's adoption. I think it's time to think of someone else besides me. Before, I only wanted to change the world. I still want that, but it's ironic how I never wanted to change myself. Yet that's where revolutions start, and it's the only way revolutions can continue, if we keep looking inward, looking at how others might see us. That's what happened when I met Sophia. I saw myself the way she saw me. With that, he lapsed into silence. My resolve was so weakened I could not raise my right arm to reach into the bag for the gun. "Listen," I said, "I have something to confess to you." "So you do love Sophia." He looked genuinely sad. "I'm sorry. I'm not here because of Miss Mori. Can we just talk about politics instead?" "As you wish. I asked you before if you were a communist. You said you wouldn't tell me if you were. But what if I told you I was a communist?" He smiled, shaking his head. "I don't believe in the hypothetical," he said. "What's the point of playing a game of what or who you might be?" "It's not a game," I said. "I am a communist. I'm your ally. I have been an agent for the opposition and the revolution for years. What do you think about that?" "What do I think?" He hesitated in disbelief. Then his face turned bright red in fury. "I don't believe it at all, is what I think. I think you've come here to trick me. You want me to say I'm a communist too, so you can kill me or expose me, don't you?" "I'm trying to help you," I said. "How exactly are you trying to help me?" I had no answer to his question. I confess that I do not know what brought me to make my confession to him. Or rather, I did not know then, but perhaps I do know now. I had worn my mask for so long, and here was my opportunity to take it off, safely. I had stumbled to this action instinctively, out of a feeling that was not unique to me. I cannot be the only one who believes that if others just saw who I really was, then I would be understood, and perhaps loved. But what would happen if one took off the mask, and the other saw one not with love, but with horror, disgust, and anger? What if the self that one exposes is as unpleasing to others as the mask, or even worse? "Did the general put you up to this?" he said. "I can see the two of you plotting away. If I was gone, it would be good for him and for you, no doubt." "Listen to me. You're jealous because I have Sophia, even though you don't even love her. I knew you'd be angry, but I didn't think you'd stoop this low to come and bait me. How stupid do you think I am? Do you think you'd suddenly be attractive to Sophia again if you said you were a communist? You don't think she'd smell your desperation and laugh in your face? My God, I can't even imagine what she'll say when I tell her." Although it seemed impossible to miss from 5 feet away, it is very possible, especially after too much wine and a tumbler or two of bourbon, suffused with the bitter peat of the past. The bullet punctured the radio, muffling but not silencing it. He looked at me in utter astonishment, his gaze fixed on the gun in my hand, the silencer adding a few more inches. I had stopped breathing. My heart had ceased beating. The gun jerked and he cried out, pierced in the hand that he had flung up. Suddenly awakened to his impending death, he leaped to his feet and turned to run. The third bullet struck between shoulder blade and spine, staggering but not stopping him as I jumped over the coffee table, catching up before he reached the door. Now I was in the ideal position, or so Bond told me, a foot behind my subject, in his blind spot, where one really could not miss. Click-clack went the gun, one bullet behind the ear, another in the skull, and Sonny fell face first with enough graceless weight to break his nose. I stood over his prone body, cheek down on the carpet, copious amounts of blood gushing from the holes drilled in his head. At the angle at which I stood, behind him, I could not see his eyes, but I could see his upturned hand with the bloody hole in his palm, his arm bent awkwardly beside him. The lump of starch had dissolved, but now its liquid results sloshed in my guts and threatened to spill. I inhaled deeply and exhaled slowly. I thought of Miss Mori, most likely at home, cat on her lap, reading a radical feminist treatise, waiting for Sonny to call. The call that would never come. The call that defined our relationship to God, whom we forlorn lovers were always calling. Now Sonny had crossed the greatest divide, leaving behind only his cold, darkened shade, his lamp forever extinguished. On the back of his cardigan a crimson stain spread, while around his head a bloody halo swelled. A wave of nausea and chills shook me, and my mother said, "You'll be better than all of them, won't you, my son?" I inhale deeply and exhale slowly, once, twice, and one more time, slowing my shaking to a trembling. Remember, Bond said inside my head, you're doing what has to be done. The list of other things in need of doing returned. I took off my windbreaker and T-shirt and put my blue polo shirt back on. The jeans and canvas shoes came off, replaced by khakis and loafers. I reversed the windbreaker to expose the plain white side, swapped the fedora for the wig, its blonde hair touching the base of my neck, and put on the baseball cap. Last came the tinted glasses, my change complete after the tote bag and the gun went into the backpack. The wig, cap, and glasses were Bond's idea. He had made me try to look on in front of the bathroom mirror, foggy with a year's worth of spattered toothpaste foam. See, he said, now you're a white man. To me, I still look like me, hidden by a disguise much too normal for a masked ball or a Halloween party. But that was the point. If someone did not know what I looked like, I did not look like I was in disguise. I wiped the fingerprints off my glass with my handkerchief, and it was with the handkerchief wrapped around the doorknob that I thought I heard Sonny moan. I looked down at the back of his shattered head, but I could hear nothing more above the thrumming of blood in my ears. You know what you have to do, Bond said. I got on my knees, lowering my face to look Sonny in his one exposed eye. When the liquid contents of my dinner rose up against the back of my throat, I clapped my hand over my mouth. I swallowed hard and tasted vileness. Sonny's eye was lusterless and blank. He must surely be dead. But as Bond had told me, sometimes the dead did not know they were dead yet. So it was that I reached forth my index finger, slowly, closer and closer to that eye, which moved not at all. My finger hovered an inch before the eye, then a few millimeters, no movement. Then my finger touched that soft, rubbery eye, the texture of a peeled quail egg, and he blinked. I jumped back as his body shuddered just a little, and then I fired another bullet into his temple from a foot away. Now, Bond said, he's dead. I inhaled deeply, exhaled slowly, and almost threw up. A little more than 3 minutes had elapsed since the first shot. I inhaled deeply, exhaled slowly, and my liquid contents achieved precarious equilibrium. After all was still, I opened Sonny's door and walked out with presidential confidence, as Bond recommended. Breathe, Claude said. So I breathed, running down the echoing stairway, and I breathed once more as I exited into the lobby where the front door was opening. He was a white man, the lawnmower of middle age having blazed a broad swatch of baldness through his hair, the well-tailored, cheap-looking suit bolted to his considerable body implied he worked in one of those low-paying professions where appearances counted, where one worked on commission. His wingtips glistened with the sheen of frozen fish. I knew all this because I looked at him, which Bond said not to do. Don't make eye contact. Don't give people a reason to give you a second look. But he did not even look at me. Eyes straight ahead, he walked by as if I were invisible, a ghost, or, more likely, just another unremarkable white man. I passed through his vapor trail of artificial pheromone, the dime store cologne of the macho male, and caught the front door before it closed. Then I was on the street, breathing in the Southern California air, fine-grained with the particulates of smog, heady with the realization that I could go wherever I wanted. I made it as far as my car. There, kneeling by the wheel well, I vomited, heaving until nothing was left, staining the gutter with the tea leaves of my insides. Chapter 17 It's normal, Bond said the next morning. He soothed the hematoma swelling from my mind with the aid of a fine bottle of scotch, granted by the general. It just had to be done, and we're the ones who have to live with it. Now you understand. Drink up. We drank up. You know what the best cure is? I had thought the best cure was to return to Lana, which I had done after leaving Sunny's apartment. But even an unforgettable evening with her had not helped me forget what I had done to Sunny. I shook my head slowly, careful not to rattle my bruised brain. Getting back to the battlefield. You'll feel better in Thailand. If that was true, then fortunately I did not have to wait long. We were leaving tomorrow. The scheduling plan to help me avoid any possibility of entanglement with the law, and to avoid my plot's obvious weakness, Miss Mori. On hearing of Sunny's death, her first thoughts might be confused, but her subsequent thoughts would turn to me, her jilted lover. The general had trusted that I would get the deed done on the date I promised, and he had provided me with my ticket the previous week. We were in his office, the newspaper on his desk, and when I opened my mouth, he lifted his hand and said, "It goes without saying, Captain." I closed my mouth. I inspected the ticket, and that evening I wrote to my Parisian aunt. In code, I told Mann that I accepted the responsibility for disobeying his orders, but that I was returning with Bond to save his life. I did not inform Mann of my plan for how to do that, because I still did not have one. But I had gotten Bond into the situation, and it was up to me to get him out of it if I could. So, 2 days after the deed was done, with no one yet having noticed Sunny's absence, except perhaps for Miss Mori, we left with no fanfare aside from that provided by the General and Madame at the airport gate. There were 4 of us departing on this unlikely trip: Bond, myself, the grizzled captain, and the affectless lieutenant, slung across the Pacific in a 2-wheeler subsonic Boeing airliner. "Goodbye, America," the grizzled captain said during our ascent, looking out the window at a landscape I could not see from my aisle seat. "I have had enough of you," he said. The affectless lieutenant, sitting in the middle, agreed. "Why did we ever call it the beautiful country?" he said. I had no answer. I was in a daze and terribly uncomfortable, sharing my seat as I was with the crapulent major on one side and Sonny on the other. It was only my 7th time on a jet airplane. I had flown to and from America for college, then flew with Bond from Saigon to Guam and Guam to California, followed by my round trip to the Philippines, and now this. My chances of returning to America were small, and I thought with regret about all the things I would miss about America: the TV dinner, air conditioning, a well-regulated traffic system that people actually followed, a relatively low rate of death by gunfire, at least compared with our homeland, the modernist novel, freedom of speech, which, if not as absolute as Americans like to believe, was still greater in degree than in our homeland, sexual liberation, and, perhaps most of all, that omnipresent American narcotic, optimism, the unending flow of which poured through the American mind continuously, whitewashing the graffiti of despair, rage, hatred, and nihilism scrawled there nightly by the black hoodlums of the unconscious. There were also many things about America with which I was less enchanted. But why be negative? I would leave the anti-American negativity and pessimism to Bond, who had never assimilated and was relieved to go. "It's like I've been hiding in someone else's house," he said, somewhere over the Pacific. He was sitting across the aisle from me. The Japanese stewardess were serving tempura and tonkatsu, which tasted better than the last word the general had forced into my mouth at the departure gate. "In between the walls," Bond said, "listening to other people live, coming out only at night. I can breathe now. We're going back where everyone looks like us." "Like you," I said. "I don't look like everyone there," Bond sighed. "Stop bitching and moaning," he said, filling my teacup with the whiskey the general had given him at the gate. "Your problem isn't that you think too much. Your problem is letting everyone know what you're thinking." "So I'll just shut up then," I said. "Yes, just shut up," he said. "All right then, I'll shut up," I said. "Jesus Christ," he said. After a sleepless 20-hour trek that involved changing planes in Tokyo, we arrived in Bangkok. I was exhausted, not having been able to sleep. Every time I closed my eyes, I saw either the crapulent major's face or Sonny's, which I could not bear to look at for long. Thus, it was not surprising that when I picked up my rucksack from the baggage carousel, I found it to be heavier than I remembered, loaded as it was now with guilt, dread, and anxiety. The overstuffed rucksack was my only piece of luggage, for before leaving our apartment, we had given the key to the Reverend Ramon and told him to sell our things and keep the money for his Church of Everlasting Prophets. All my belongings now fit in the rucksack, my copy of Asian Communism and the Oriental Mode of Destruction in its false bottom, the book so well worn it had nearly split in two along its cracked spine. Everything else we needed would be provided in Thailand, the general said. Matters would be handled by the admiral in charge of the base camp, and by Claude, who would be there in a guise familiar to him, working for a non-governmental organization that assisted refugees. He greeted us at the international gate, dressed in a Hawaiian shirt and linen pants, looking the same as I had seen him last at Professor Hammer's house, except for being deeply tanned. "It's great to see you guys," he said, shaking my hand and those of the others. "Welcome to Bangkok. You guys ever been here?" "Didn't think so." "We've got one night, and we're painting the town red. My treat." He threw his arm around my shoulders and squeezed with genuine affection, leading me through the throbbing crowd and toward the exit. Perhaps it was only my state of mind, its consistency close to porridge, but every one of the natives we passed seemed to be looking at the two of us. I wondered if among them was one of Mann's agents. "You look good," Claude said. "You ready to do this thing?" "Of course," I said, all my dread and anxiety bubbling in a compartment somewhere behind my bowels. I had the vertiginous feeling one gets standing at the precipice of an unresolved plan, for I had brought Bond and myself to the brink of disaster without knowing how to save us. But was not this how all plans developed, unknown to their maker until he wove himself a parachute or else melted into air? I could hardly ask that question of Claude, who always seemed to be the master of his own fate, at least until the fall of Saigon. He squeezed my shoulder again. "I'm proud of you, buddy. I just want you to know that." We both walked in silence for a moment, allowing the sentiment to circulate. And then he squeezed my shoulder again and said, "I'm going to show you the best time of your life." I grinned, and he grinned, the thing unsaid being that this might be the last best time of my life. His enthusiasm and concern touched me, his way of saying he loved me, or possibly his way of providing me with the equivalent of a doomed man's last meal. He led us outside the terminal and into the seasonable late December weather, the best time of the year to visit the region. We loaded ourselves into a van, and Claude said, "You don't get over jet lag by going to a hotel and getting some sleep. I'm going to keep you awake until nighttime, and then tomorrow we're setting out for the camp." The driver steered us onto a road jammed with vans, trucks, and motorbikes. We were surrounded by the honking, beeping, and roaring of an urban metropolis engorged with automotive metal, human flesh, and unspoken emotion. "Remind you guys of home?" said Claude. "This is the closest you guys have been for years. Same, same like Saigon," the grizzled captain said. "Same, same, but different," said Claude. "No war and no refugees. All that's on the border where you guys are going." Claude passed out cigarettes, and we all lit up. "First it was the Laotians running across the border. Now we have a lot of Hmong. All very sad, but helping refugees does not get us access to the countryside." The effectless lieutenant shook his head and said, "Laos. Very evil communists there." Claude said, "Is there any other kind? But Laos itself is the closest thing to paradise Indochina's got. I spent time there during the war, and it was incredible. I love those people. They're the gentlest, most hospitable people on earth, except when they want to kill you." When he exhaled smoke, the tiny fan mounted on the dashboard blew it back toward us. At some point, had Claude and other foreigners considered us to be the gentlest, most hospitable people on earth? Or had we always been a warlike, aggressive people? I suspected the latter. As the driver exited from the freeway, Claude nudged me and said, "I heard about what you did." "What I did? What did I do?" When Claude said nothing and kept his steady gaze on me, I remembered the one thing that I had done that must be passed over in silence. "Oh, yeah," I muttered. "Don't feel bad," said Claude. "From what the general told me, that guy was asking for it." "I can guarantee you he didn't ask for it," I said. "That's not what I meant," said Claude. "It's just that I've seen plenty of his kind. Professional malcontents, self-righteous masochists. They're so unhappy with everything that they're never going to be happy until they're trussed for execution. And you know what his kind would say when he's facing the firing squad? 'I told you so.' The only thing different in your case is that the poor slob didn't have time to think about it." "If you say so, Claude," I said. "Well, I'm not saying so," he said. "It's in the book. He's the guilt-ridden character." I could see the pages of the book that Claude was referring to, the interrogation manual we had pored over in his course, the book that went under the name Kubark. It had definitions of several character types the interrogator was likely to meet. And unbidden, the paragraph about the guilt-ridden character rippled before my eyes. This kind of person has a strong, cruel, unrealistic conscience. His whole life seems devoted to reliving his feelings of guilt. Sometimes he seems determined to atone. At other times, he insists that whatever went wrong is the fault of somebody else. In either event, he seeks constantly some proof or external indication that the guilt of others is greater than his own. He is often caught up completely in efforts to prove that he has been treated unjustly. In fact, he may provoke unjust treatment in order to assuage his conscience through punishment. Persons with intense guilt feelings may cease resistance and cooperate if punished in some way, because of the gratification induced by punishment. Perhaps this was, indeed, Sunny, but I would never know for sure, as I would have no more opportunities to interrogate him. "Here we are," said Claude. Our destination was an alley over which hung a rainbow of artificial neon light, the sidewalks thronged with pale-faced primates of all ages and sizes, some with military crew cuts, and some with the long hair of the hippie tribe, all inebriated or about to be inebriated, many howling and hooting in considerable agitation. Bars and clubs lined the entire alley, and in the doorways stood girls with bare limbs and exquisitely painted features. The van stopped at an establishment, above whose door rose a gigantic vertical sign in bright yellow that spelled Golden Cock. The door was held open by two girls, who appeared to be 20 or so, which meant that they were most likely anywhere from 15 to 18. They stood on 6-inch heels and wore what euphemistically could be called clothing, halter tops and bikini bottoms not even as substantial as their kind smiles, as loving and gentle as those of kindergarten teachers. "Oh, boy," said the grizzled captain, grinning so widely I could see his decaying molars. Even the effectless lieutenant said, "Nice," though he did not smile. "Glad you like it," said Claude. "It's all for you." The effectless lieutenant and the grizzled captain had already entered when Bond said, "No, I walk." "What? A walk?" Claude said. "You want private company? You'll get it, trust me. These girls are veterans. They know how to take care of shy guys." Bond shook his head, the look in his eyes almost one of fear. "It's okay," I said. "I'll take a walk with you." "Hell no," Claude said, grabbing Bond by the elbow. "I get it. Not every guy's up for this kind of thing. But take a walk and you deny your good buddy here the night of his life. So just come on in and sit down and have some drinks. You don't have to touch. You don't even have to look if you don't want to. Just sit with your eyes closed. But you're doing it for your pal, not yourself. How about it?" I put my hand on Claude's arm and said, "It's okay, leave him alone." "Not you, too," said Claude. "Yes, me too." Bond had apparently infected me with his morality, a disease likely to be fatal. I offered him a cigarette after Claude gave up attempting to persuade us and went inside. And together we stood there, smoking, ignoring the touts tugging at our shirts, but unable to ignore the passing troops of tourists who bumped and shoved us. "God," someone said behind me. "Did you see what she did with that ping-pong ball, mate?" "Bing pong ching chong," someone else said. "Long shlong duk dong, bloody hell, I think the bitch pinched my wallet." Bond threw his cigarette away and said, "Let's get out of here before I kill somebody." I shrugged. "Where to?" He pointed over my shoulder, and when I turned, I saw the movie poster that had caught his eye. We watched The Hamlet in a movie theater full of locals who had not yet learned that cinema was a hallowed art form, that one did not, during the performance, blow one's nose without a tissue, bring one's own snack, beverage, or picnic, beat one's child, or conversely, sing a crying baby a lullaby, call out affectionately to friends several rows away, discuss past, present, and future plot points with one's seatmate, or sprawl so widely in one's seat that one's thigh rested against the neighbor's for the entire duration. But who was to say they were wrong? How else could one tell whether a movie was faring well or badly if the audience did not respond to it? The audience seemed to enjoy themselves thoroughly, given the cheering and clapping, and, God help me, if I did not also find myself caught up in the story and the sheer spectacle. The scene the audience reacted to most strongly was the climactic battle, during which my own jet-lagged heart also beat faster. Perhaps it was the menacing Beethoven-like score, with its infernal repetition of notes saturated in the devil's deep pitch, dum-dum-da-dum-dum-da-dum-da. Perhaps it was the hissing helicopter blades, reduced to slow-motion sound. Perhaps it was the cross-cutting between the gazes of Bellamy and Seamus, riding their airborne steeds, the gazes of the Viet Cong girls peering through the crosshairs of their anti-aircraft cannons. Perhaps it was the bombs bursting in air. Perhaps it was the sight of the Viet Cong savages being given a bloodbath, the only kind of bath they were likely to take. Perhaps it was all these things that made me wish for a gun in my hand so I, too, could participate in the Old Testament slaughter of the Viet Cong who looked, if not exactly like me, fairly close to me. They certainly looked exactly like my fellow spectators, who whooped and laughed as a variety of American-made weaponry vaporized, vulparized, lacerated, and splattered their not-so-distant neighbors. I twisted in my seat, fully awoken from my torpor. I wanted to close my eyes but could not, unable to do more than blink a few times rapidly since the preceding scene, the only one where the audience had fallen completely quiet. This was also the only scene I had not filmed. The auteur used no music, the agony unreeling with only my screams and protests, underscored by the VC quartet's laughing, cursing, and jeering. The lack of music only made more audible the audience's sudden silence, and mothers, who had not bothered to turn away their children's faces from the gutting, shooting, hacking, and decapitation, now clapped their hands over the eyes of their babes. Long shots from the cave's darkened corners depicted a human octopus writhing at the cave's center, the naked Mai struggling under the backs and limbs of her half-naked rapists. While we saw glimpses of her naked body, most of it was obscured by the strategically placed legs, arms, and buttocks of the VC, with the flesh tones, the scarlet blood, and their tattered black and brown clothing rendered in a painterly Renaissance shading that recalled for me faint memories of an art history class. Alternating with these long shots were extreme close-ups of Mai's battered face with its howling mouth and bloody nose, one eye so swollen it had closed completely. The most extended shot of the movie was devoted to this face filling the entire screen, her open eye wheeling in its socket, blood sputtering on her lips as she screamed, "Mama! Mama! Mama!" I cringed, and when finally the movie cut to the reverse shot, and we saw these red-skinned demons as seen from Mai's eyes, faces flushed from home-brewed rice wine, bare teeth crusty with lichen, squinty eyes squeezed shut in ecstasy, the only possible feeling burning in one's gut was the desire for their utter extinction. This was what the auteur provided next, in the gruesome finale of hand-to-hand combat, which could also double as a medical school training film in anatomical dissection. But the movie's last shot, of innocent Danny Boy sitting in the open doorway of a Huey helicopter ascending slowly into the clear blue heavens, weeping as he gazed over his war-ravaged homeland, destined for a country where women's breasts produce not just milk but milkshakes, or so the GIs told him, I had to admit to the auteur's talent, the way one might admire the technical genius of a master gunsmith. He had hammered into existence a thing of beauty and horror, exhilarating for some and deadly for others, a creation whose purpose was destruction. As the credits began rolling, I felt touched by shame for having contributed to this dark work, but also pride in the contribution of my extras. Faced with ungrateful roles, they had comported themselves with as much grace as possible. There were the four veterans who played VC Rapist No. 1, VC Rapist No. 2, VC Rapist No. 3, and VC Rapist No. 4. As well as the others who had made their screen debuts as Desperate Villager, Dead Girl, Lame Boy, Corrupt Officer, Pretty Nurse, Blind Beggar, Sad Refugee, Angry Clerk, Weeping Widow, Idealistic Student, Gentle Whore, and Crazy Guy in Whorehouse. But I did not take pride in just my own. There were also all those colleagues who dedicated themselves behind the scenes, like Harry. This artist was sure to score an Oscar nomination for his fanatically detailed sets, his valuable work unmarred even by the minor incident involving his hiring of a local fixer to furnish actual corpses from a nearby graveyard for the finale. To the gendarmes who came to arrest him, he said, with genuine contriteness, I didn't think it was illegal, officers. All was reconciled with the speedy return of the corpses to their graves, and a substantial donation by the auteur to the Policeman's Benevolent Association, otherwise known as the local brothel. I grimaced at seeing Violet's name as assistant producer, but conceded that she had a right to come before me in the hierarchy of credits. I recalled fondly the unending sustenance supplied by the artisans of craft services, the dedicated care of the first aid team, and the efficient daily transportation provided by the drivers, although, to be frank, my services were more specialized than any of those. I do admit that perhaps my bicultural, bilingual skills were not as unique as those of the trainer who taught various tricks and commands to the adorable mutt playing the adopted native pet of the Green Berets, credited as Smitty the Dog, or the exotic animal handler who flew in on a DC-3 charter with a surly Bengal tiger in a cage, Lily, and who ensured the docility of the elephants, Abbott and Costello. But while I admired the cheerful, prompt work of the laundresses, Delia, Mary Bell, Corazon, and so on, did they merit appearing before me? The names of the laundresses continued their upward scroll, and it was only with the acknowledgments of the mayor, the councilman, the head of the tourist bureau, the Philippine Armed Forces, and First Lady Imelda Marcos and President Ferdinand Marcos, that I realized my name was never coming at all. By the time the soundtrack and film stock credits had passed, my grudging acknowledgment of the auteur had evaporated, replaced by boiling, murderous rage. Failing to do away with me in real life, he had succeeded in murdering me in fiction, obliterating me utterly in a way that I was becoming more and more acquainted with. I was still steaming as we left the theater, my emotions hotter than the temperate night. "What did you think?" I asked Bond, silent as usual after a movie. He smoked his cigarette and waved for a taxi. "Well, what did you think?" He finally looked at me, his gaze a mix of pity and disappointment. "You're going to make sure we came off well," he said. "But we weren't even human." A rattling taxi pulled to the curb. "Now you're a movie critic?" I said. "Just my opinion, college boy," he said, climbing inside. "What do I know?" "If it wasn't for me," I said, slamming the door shut, "there wouldn't even be any roles at all for our people. We would just be target practice." He sighed and rolled his window down. "All you did was give them an excuse," he said. "Now, white people can say, 'Look, we got yellow people in here. We don't hate them. We love them.'" He spat out the window. "You tried to play their game, okay? But they run the game. You don't run anything. That means you can't change anything, not from the inside. When you got nothing, you got to change things from the outside." We spoke no more for the duration of the ride, and when we got to our hotel, he fell asleep almost right away. I lay in our darkened room with an ashtray on my chest, smoking and contemplating how I had failed at the one task both man and the general could agree on, the subversion of the movie and all it represented, namely our misrepresentation. I tried to fall asleep but could not, kept awake by the blare of horns and the unnerving sight of Sonny and the crapulent major lying on the ceiling above me, behaving as if they always passed their time thus. The monotonous squeaking of bed springs next door did not help, the squeaking going on for such an absurdly long time that I felt sorry for what I assumed was a poor, silent woman enduring it all. When the male involved squawked his battle cry, I was relieved it was all over, although it wasn't, for when that concluded, his partner uttered his own deep, protracted, appreciative masculine mating call. The surprises just would not end, not since the general and madame came to see us off at the airport, he in a herringbone suit and she in a lilac au dye. He presented us four heroes with a bottle of whiskey each, taken a picture with us, and shook each of our hands before we passed through the ticket gate, myself coming last. With me, however, he held on and said, "Just a word, Captain." I stepped aside to let the other passengers board. "Yes, sir?" "You know Madam and I look on you as our adopted son," said the general. "I didn't know that, sir." The look on his face and Madame's was grim, but that was the same look my father usually gave me. "How could you, then?" said Madame. "I was used to dissembling, and I manufactured a look of surprise. How could I what?" "Try to seduce our daughter," the general said. "Everyone's talking about it," said Madame. "Everyone?" I said. "The rumors," the general said. I should have seen it when you spoke with her at the wedding, but no, it never occurred to me that you would encourage my daughter in her nightclub pursuits. Not only this, Madame added, but the two of you made a spectacle out of yourselves at the nightclub. Everyone saw it. The general sighed. That you would attempt to defile her, he said, was something I could hardly believe. Not after you've lived in my house and treated her as a child and a sister. A sister, Madame emphasized. I am sorely disappointed in you, said the general. I wanted you here by my side. I would never have let you go except for this. Sir, you should have known better, Captain. You are a soldier. Everything and everyone belongs in his proper place. How could you ever believe we would allow our daughter to be with someone of your kind? My kind, I said. What do you mean by my kind? Oh, Captain, said the general, you are a fine young man, but you are also, in case you have not noticed, a bastard. They waited for me to say something, but the general had stuffed the one word in my mouth that could silence me. Seeing that I had nothing to say, they shook their heads in anger, sorrow, and recrimination, leaving me at the gate with my bottle of whiskey. I wanted to crack it open then and there, for the whiskey might have helped me spit that word out. It was stuck in my throat and had the taste of a woolen sock sodden with our homeland's rich mud. The kind of meal I had forgotten was reserved for those who ranked among the meanest. We arose before the sun to a dark morning. After a breakfast where no one uttered more than a grunt, Claude drove from Bangkok to the camp, a day's journey that ended near the border with Laos. By the time he swerved onto an unpaved side road and into a white-barked cage-put forest, dodging craters and dips, the sun was rolling on its own downward slope behind us. 1 kilometer into the twilight forest, we reached a military checkpoint consisting of a jeep and 2 young soldiers in olive-green battle dress, each with a protective amulet of the Buddha around his neck and an M16 in his lap. I smelled the unmistakable funk of marijuana. Without bothering either to rise from the jeep or to raise their half-lidded eyes, the soldiers waved us through. We continued on the rutted road, plunging even deeper into a forest, where the skeletal hands of tall trees with their thin branches loomed over us, until we emerged into a clearing of small square huts on stilts, the scene saved from total rusticity by the electric light illuminating the windows. Wigs of palm leaves thatched the roofs, and wooden planks led from elevated doors to the earth. Barking dogs had brought shadows to the mouths of the doorways, and by the time we clambered out, a squad of those shadows was approaching. "There they are," said Claude, "the last men standing of the armed forces of the Republic of Vietnam." Perhaps the pictures of them that I had seen in the general's office were taken in better times, but those stern freedom fighters bore little resemblance to these haggard irregulars. In the pictures, those clean-shaven men with red scarves cinched around their necks had been clad in jungle camouflage, combat boots and berets, standing at attention under the forest-filtered sunlight. But instead of boots and camouflage, these men wore rubber sandals with black blouses and pants. Instead of red scarves, the ranger's legendary emblem, they wore the checkered scarves of peasants. Instead of berets, they wore wide-brimmed bushwhacker hats. Instead of clean cheeks, they were unshaven, their hair matted and untrimmed. Their eyes, once hot and bright, were dull as coal. Each carried an AK-47 with its distinctive banana clip, and the presence of this icon, combined with all the other features, led to an unusual visual effect. "Why do they all look like Viet Cong?" said the grizzled captain. It was not only the guerrillas who resembled their old enemies, as we discovered when 12 of them led us to the hut of their commander. On this hut's thin lip of a porch stood a slim man, backlit by a bare electric light bulb. "Isn't that..." said Bon, before stopping at asking the absurd. "Everybody says so," said Claude. The admiral raised his hand in greeting and smiled a familiar, avuncular smile. His face was angular, gaunt, and almost handsome, the classic noble visage of a scholar or mandarin. The hair was gray but not white, thinning a little on top and trimmed short. A goatee was his most distinctive feature, a neatly sculpted affair for the man of middle age, rather than the scraggle of youth or the long, flowing tuft of the elder. "Welcome, then," the admiral said, and even in the gentle intonation of his voice I heard echoes of the newsreel on which Ho Chi Minh's cultivated and calm voice was recorded. You have traveled a great distance, and you must be tired. Please, come in and join me. Like Ho Chi Minh, the admiral referred to himself as uncle. Like Ho Chi Minh, he also dressed with simplicity, his black blouse and pants matching the garb of his guerrillas. And, like Ho Chi Minh, he furnished his quarters in a sparse and scholarly fashion. We sat barefoot on reed mats in the hut's one plain room, us newcomers uneasy in the presence of this uncanny look-alike. Our apparition must have slept on the plank floor, for there was no sign of a bed. Bamboo bookshelves lined one wall, and a simple bamboo desk and chair occupied another. Over the course of dinner, as we drank the general's whiskey, the admiral quizzed us on our years in America, and we quizzed him in turn on how he had come to be shipwrecked in the forest. He smiled and tapped his ashes into an ashtray made of half a coconut shell. On the last day of the war, I was in command of a transport ship full of marines, soldiers, policemen, and civilians rescued from the piers. I could have sailed to the Seventh Fleet, like many of my fellow captains, but the Americans had betrayed us before, and there was no hope of fighting again if I fled to them. The Americans were finished. Now that their white race had failed, they were leaving Asia to the yellow race. So I sailed toward Thailand. I had Thai friends, and I knew the Thai would give us asylum. They had nowhere to go, unlike the Americans. The Thai would fight communism because it was pressing up against their border with Cambodia. Laos, too, was going to fall soon. You see, I was not interested in being saved, unlike so many of our countrymen. He paused here and smiled once more, and none of us needed to be reminded that we were some of those countrymen. God had already saved me, the admiral went on. I did not need to be saved by Americans. I swore on my ship in front of my men that we would continue our fight for months, years, even decades, if necessary. If we looked at our struggle from God's eyes, this was no time at all. So, Bond said, you think we really have a chance, Uncle? The admiral stroked his goatee before answering. My child, he said, still stroking the goatee. Remember Jesus and how Christianity began with just him, his apostles, their faith, and the word of God. We are like those true believers. We have 200 apostles in this camp, a radio station broadcasting the word of freedom into our enslaved homeland, and guns. We have things Jesus and his apostles never had. But we have their faith too, and not least, furthest from least, God is on our side. Bond lit another cigarette. Jesus died, he said. So did the apostles. So we're going to die, said the effectless lieutenant. Despite the meaning of his words, or perhaps because of them, his manner and pronouncement remained unemotional. Not that that's a bad thing, he said. I am not saying you will die on this mission, said the admiral. Just eventually. But if you do die on this mission, know that those you save will be grateful to you, as those the apostles saved were grateful to them. A lot of the people they went to save didn't want to be saved, Uncle, Bond said. That's why they ended up dead. My son, the admiral said, no longer smiling, it does not sound like you are a believer. If by that you mean a believer in religion or anti-communism or freedom or anything with a big word like that, no, I'm not. I used to believe, but not anymore. I don't give a damn about saving anybody, including myself. I just want to kill communists. That's why I'm the man you want. I can live with that, the admiral said. Chapter 18. We spent 2 weeks acclimating to the weather and our new comrades, among whom were three characters I had never expected to see again. These marine lieutenants were bearded and longer-haired than on the night Bond, Mann, and I had encountered them in that Saigon alley, singing, "Beautiful Saigon, O Saigon, O Saigon," but they were still recognizably dumb. They had made their way to the docks on the day Saigon fell, and there had jumped on board the admiral's ship. "We've been in Thailand ever since," said the marine who was the leader of the three. He had been steeped in the Mekong Delta his entire life, as his comrades had been, all of them branded by a life in the sun, although in different shades. He was dark, but one of the other marines was darker, and the third was the darkest of all, black as a cup of black tea. They, Bond and I, grudgingly shook hands. "We're going with you across the border," said the dark marine, "so we better get on each other's right sides." This was the marine on whom I had drawn my pistol, but since he chose not to mention this fact, neither did I. Altogether, there were a dozen of us on the reconnaissance team that set out early one night, led by a Lao farmer and a Hmong scout. The Lao farmer had no choice in the matter. He had been kidnapped by the Admiral's men on an earlier reconnaissance, and was now being used as a guide, given his knowledge of the terrain through which we were traveling. He could not speak Vietnamese, but the Hmong scout could and served as his translator. Even from a distance, one could see that the scout's eyes were a ruin, dark and shattered as the windows of an abandoned palace. He was clad in black, as we all were, but he was unique in wearing a faded green beret a size too large, the brim resting on his ears and eyebrows. Following him were two of the Marines, the dark one armed with an AK-47, and the darker one with our M-79 elephant gun, its stubby grenades resembling short metallic dildos. After the Marines came the effectless lieutenant and the grizzled captain, who could not bring themselves to carry the enemy's AK-47, and instead toted the M-16. Behind them was the skinny RTO, grease gun in hand and PRC-25 radio on his back. Next was the philosophical medic, M3 medical kit hanging from one shoulder, and M14 from the other, as no man on this reconnaissance could go unarmed. He and I had hit it off right away during an evening perfumed with jasmine and marijuana. "Besides sadness and sorrow," he had asked me, "what's really heavy but weighs nothing at all?" When he saw that I was stumped, he said, "Nihilism," which was in fact his philosophy. Then came the hefty machine gunner, M60 in his arms, with myself and Bon next, me with an AK-47, Bon with the M16. Bringing up the rear was the darkest Marine, his weapon the B-40 rocket launcher. For defense, in place of bulletproof vests and helmets, each of us was given a laminated, wallet-sized picture of the Virgin Mary to wear over our hearts. The Admiral had blessed us with these gifts on our departure from the camp, which was, for most of us, a relief. We had spent our days discussing tactics, preparing rations, and studying the map of our route through the southern end of Laos. This was terrain probed by the Marines on earlier reconnaissance, home to the Lao farmer. Smugglers, he claimed, crossed the border all the time. Periodically, we listened to Radio Free Vietnam, its crew working from a bamboo shack next to the Admiral's hut. From there, they broadcast the Admiral's speeches, read items translated from newspapers, and aired pop songs with reactionary sentiments, James Taylor and Donna Summer being particular favorites of the season. "The communists hate love songs," said the Admiral. "They don't believe in love or romance or entertainment. They believe the people should only love the revolution and the country. But the people love love songs, and we serve the people." The airwaves bore those love songs laden with emotion across Laos and into our homeland. In my pocket was a transistor radio with an earpiece so I could listen to the broadcast, and I valued it more than my weapon or the Virgin Mary. Claude, who did not believe in her or any god, gave us his secular blessing in the form of high fives as we left. "Good luck," he said. "Just in and out, quick and quiet." Easier said than done, I thought. I kept that idea to myself, but I suspected that many of the dozen of us might have been thinking the same thing. Claude intuited my worry when he squeezed my shoulder. "Take care of yourself, buddy. If anybody starts shooting, just keep your head down. Let the pros do the fighting." His estimation of my abilities was moving and most likely accurate. He wanted to keep me safe, this man who, along with man, had taught me everything I knew about the practices of intelligence, of secrecy as a way of life. "We'll be waiting for you guys to come back," said Claude. "See you soon," I said. That was all. We set off on our march under a sliver of moon, cheered by the optimism that one sometimes had at the beginning of strenuous exercise, a kind of helium that filled our lungs and carried us along. Then after an hour we trudged, or at least I trudged, my helium depleted and replaced with the first hints of fatigue, soaking into the body as the slow drip of water soaks into a towel. A few hours into our march, we arrived at a pool of water, where the grizzled captain called for a rest. Sitting on the edge of the moonlit pool and resting my sore thighs, I could just make out the phosphorescent, disembodied hands of my wristwatch, pointing to 1 in the morning. My hands felt as detached as the watch's hands, for what they wanted was to hold and caress one of the cigarettes in my breast pocket, the urge electrifying my nervous system. Seemingly unaffected by any similar yearning, Bond sat down next to me and silently ate a rice ball. The fetid smell of mud and decaying vegetation